Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to be joining all of you again this episode. We've got a great panel here for you and a good discussion topic for us that looks at some things that, are happening that you might not be aware of in your area that is something that you need to be concerned about. And we'll talk about that coming up here in a sec. But of course, we have to introduce Sam Bradley, my amazing co-host. How you doing, Sam?
Oh, I'm amazing this week. Thank you very much. Yes, it's been nice here in northern Colorado. It's pretty warm during the day and getting colder at night. So we kind of know winter's coming. How is it back there on the East Coast?
The weather's starting to turn. I think it's going to get down into the low 40s tonight, maybe high 30s. It's November, so it'll be 30 or 40 during the nighttime and up in the 50s during the day. And then we'll have a 60 degree weather day for a couple of days. Just the weather's very mercurial this time of year.
Yeah. And we have our friend BJ Schneider with us, one of our regulars from New Orleans. I suppose it's still warm down there, eh, BJ?
No, it's amazing down here, too. We'll be in the upper 50s tonight, so can't ask for better.
That's pretty cool for you guys, isn't it?
It's pull out the jacket weather for us.
There you go. Well, Jamie, I saw, have an ABC News thing. Actually, it's from California, but I noticed a magnitude 5.3 earthquake. The headline was, has shaken central Oklahoma from November 6th, which was Sunday. And it mentioned it was, the epicenter was 1 mile west of Cushing, which is about 50 miles northeast of Oklahoma City. It was felt as far away as Kansas City, Missouri, and Little Rock, Arkansas. And then there was a 4.5 last week, with an epicenter near Pawnee. And there's a couple other points that this makes that I want to talk to my friend Chris about. So I decided this was interesting enough because, with Dr. Joe in Memphis, we've had this discussion off and on for a while about what would happen if the New Madrid Fault had a big quake under it. And some pretty amazing points came up about this. And so my friend Chris in Oklahoma, we've known each other for at least 100 years. I was his EMT instructor. He was my scuba instructor. He eventually became a medic, went to Oklahoma. And, of course, we podcasted with him quite some time ago because one of the first things he ran into when he moved to Oklahoma work in EMS was the big F5 tornado, which made him almost want to go back to California, but he stuck it out. But so I contacted Chris, and he made a few really interesting points of things I certainly didn't know, and I thought they would be worthy of discussing on the podcast. Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm awesome. It's so good to talk to you. It's been a while.
Good to talk to you guys, too. Thanks for having me.
But you weren't terribly surprised. You kind of basically said, oh, yeah, well, we're kind of averaging one a day. You've had, 5.0 or greater, the second 5.0 or greater in the last 6 to 8 months, probable shallow fault activity. And then you mentioned the Wilzetta fault, which is a strike-slip fault. Seems to be affected by wastewater injection wells from fracking. And the news article I saw said something about the Oklahoma Corporation Commission has shut down some disposal wells and ordered a reduction in the amount of wastewater disposed of. So that's something I want to ask you about. I realize you're not a geologist, but that's something most of us probably know nothing about. But before we jump into that, tell us a little about yourself and what you're doing right now.
Well, as Sam mentioned, I was an EMT basic student at Cerritos College many years ago and ended up going to paramedic school in Florida and found my way to Oklahoma City with EMSA. I spent 17 years with EMSA, both as a provider and was honored to be part of their operations and clinical management teams. About 3 years ago, I had an opportunity to move over to OU Medical System as their director of EMS relations. And I spent 2 years inside of the medical system, basically assisting in the development of care systems throughout the city and the state of Oklahoma to bring, obviously, patients into that level one trauma center and comprehensive stroke and STEMI centers. And just recently, about 4 months ago, I got a call from a colleague who I worked very closely with at EMSA who is involved in rural and super rural and government EMS contracts, and he needed some help on the operations side. So I transitioned to an organization by the name of Samaritan EMS. We are based out of Del City, Oklahoma, and I've been their operations director now for about the last 4 months.
How are you enjoying that?
I am very, very, very happy to be back on the field side. The hospital is a great learning experience and environment, but I think my talents and my strengths are with the guys and the gals out in the field taking care of people. I think that's where I fit best in our organization.
Well, that doesn't surprise me at all. So, you're done. So tell us a little bit about the, well, there's kind of 2 points to this. You've got your, you know, the activity that is occurring pretty regularly, and then you've got this fracking. To the extent that you understand this, why don't you explain to us what fracking means?
Well, basically, fracking is a technology in the oil and gas industry that is horizontal drilling and the utilization of basically water or hydraulics to fracture, you know, the term fracking, rock formations to drain more oil out of those pockets that we couldn't get into with vertical drilling. So Oklahoma, North Dakota, the west part of Texas has experienced, you know, these oil booms based on these large pockets of oil that for whatever reason technology couldn't allow us to get to. Right about 2008 in Oklahoma, there was a big spike in oil production based on fracking, and currently there are 963 what they call wastewater disposal wells within the state boundaries of Oklahoma. So when you extract a barrel of oil, it takes about 10 barrels of water to pull that one barrel of oil out of the ground. So this water's coming out of these wells. It's basically laced with toxins and heavy metal and brine and all of the things obviously we find in the Earth's crust. It's very expensive for an oil company to process that water and make it safe. So what the industry has done is they've taken and basically drilled wells to dispose of this water. The area that Sam mentioned in the Payne County area is part of the Arbuckle sedimentary rock formation. So obviously oil companies like to pump that back in, and the easier the drilling is and the more quote-unquote space they've got, that's better for their injection, and they can put that water back in. What most feel that is occurring in the state of Oklahoma is the mass amount of wastewater that's being pumped into these wells is basically getting into that sedimentary rock, the Wilzetta Fault, the Nehoma uplifting kind of crust, which is a semi kind of slip fault line that runs basically through Oklahoma City and kind of north right along the I-35 corridor. And it's creating an increase in seismic activity. It's basically acting like a lubricant against these fault lines and allowing seismic activity to happen much more frequently. To give you an idea, looking at earthquake tracks, Oklahoma, within the last 4 days, we've had 12 seismic events after that 5.3 in Cushing on Sunday. So it's right now the most seismically active area of the country.
Wow. And the article does say that scientists have linked the sharp increase in earthquakes in Oklahoma specifically to the underground disposal. So it looks like they are recognizing that and looking to consider, you know, reducing that to maybe not create, be creating this other problem. BJ or Jamie, did you have some questions on that point?
Well, I think that, you know, that it's just interesting as we talk about all the things that can go wrong, and we talk so much about preparedness and knowing the disasters and situations that can happen in your region. So I guess my question for Chris is, are these tremors of a magnitude to cause any kind of damage at any time? At what point do people think that there's going to be a reason for concern, or is this expected to only cause relatively minor seismic activity?
Well, I think the concern in Oklahoma is growing. The region that we're discussing in that Payne County and Cushing area, I'm sure a lot of people aren't familiar with you know, the state of Oklahoma, but the town of Cushing actually houses the largest oil tank battery storage in the world. So there is millions upon millions of gallons of oil stored in tank batteries, and it's also a hub of multiple pipelines that run through the U.S. So seismic activity in that particular area is obviously a national security concern. So that's really the first priority in that thought process of response. Oklahoma, obviously, is an older state. There's a lot of older buildings, and this last event in Cushing created a lot of damage in the town of Cushing, really focused around the historic buildings. But, you know, the growing sprawl of Oklahoma City and Stillwater, you know, that can be affected from the infrastructure situation with power and water. So as these are increasing in intensity, the response community seems to be working, you know, a little bit more diligently to start planning for that. The nice thing that we do have is a tornado response. So we are familiar with collapse and mass casualty incidents and things of that nature. So unfortunately, that's not new to us. But the thought process of, you know, losing large pieces of infrastructure is a bit concerning. As probably most of you know, hospitals can survive hours without, you know, running water, and then we have to move patients. Sam had mentioned the new and 2 days with some physicians out of Dallas a few summers ago, actually looking in Oklahoma City for a hospital drop point that they could open up one of their portable 200-bed hospitals in the event that we would have a New Madrid situation, that we would have to evacuate patients, you know, to communities away from that area. Now it seems like that concern may be for, you know, the greater Oklahoma City and Tulsa area. Where would we move patients? So it's really kind of an interesting time in the response and planning community in Oklahoma.
Well, and that's another question I want to ask you a little bit more about in a bit. BJ, did you have a question for Chris?
Yeah. As we talk about on the show all the time, we've learned exactly what we didn't know when we have these events happen. Hurricane Katrina for me here, where after the fact you go, we really thought we were prepared and well engaged, and turns out we didn't know quite what we thought we knew. In that vein, what are y'all looking at as far as early preparation, gaming things out with other agencies? Has any of that begun to take shape yet?
We have, a very forward-thinking and proactive system in Oklahoma. A gentleman by the name of Mike Murphy, who is based out of Oklahoma City, works for EMSA, has spent the last several years putting together a regional emergency medical response system that actually is kind of coordinated through our trauma system. So we have ambulance strike teams designated in each region of our state. And we've obviously started deploying them on some other situations, tornado incidents and things of that nature. So that would kind of roll right into a response for evacuation. The interesting thought process is that EMSA, being the largest agency in Oklahoma with the most resources, they would obviously, when a major incident in one of their cities, be obviously, you know, kind of involved in that. So the rural communities would really have to put together their ambulance strike teams and make a show at these events. Obviously, as you well know, the rural medicine in general, and especially EMS, is struggling all across the country. So that remains to be a concern, but I do have confidence that the system we have in place initially would be able to handle, you know, the initial load of an incident. I think where we would possibly get strained is if we had major evacuations with long distance patient movement. We would probably have to call in some, you know, kind of regional and national assets to probably get that done.
Wow. Yeah, that was the question I was going to ask. I mean, it seems like on a day-to-day basis, you're more prepared for tornadoes because there's a more highly likelihood of having those, especially in certain areas. But I want to refer back, and then I have a follow-up question on this. You made an interesting point about the fact that there was a Lewis and Clark reference going back into their history on this very thing that goes actually – the New Madrid Fault was active from 1811 to 1812, which is something I didn't know about. And the paragraph that you referred us to was mentioning earthquakes on December 16th, January 23rd, and February 7th, centered on the New Madrid Fault under the Mississippi River, were the 7th, 10th, 21st largest, respectively, in United States history. That's kind of a mind blower. And it has, for comparison, the 1906 San Francisco quake was the 19th largest. Scientists project that a quake like the New Madrid series today, which is entirely possible, would destroy 60% of Memphis, Tennessee. For some moments, the Mississippi River famously flowed upstream. Water and sand geysered from the earth as high as treetops and crashed down on houses. Topsoil dropped into sinkholes and lakes formed where crops had grown. Buildings collapsed. The shocks were felt as far away as New York and Kansas. Now, I sent that little ditty to Dr. Joe, who, of course, is in Memphis. And like I said earlier, we had some discussion about this, but I said, what do you think about that 60% point? And he goes, it's entirely possible. And his reasoning for that is that most of Memphis is sandy loam soil, which is a lot of what I had in California. And it doesn't have the bedrock that some of California has. And so the buildings just won't, you know, stand up to that. How does Oklahoma compare in terms of the soil and the, you know, is there solid soil under Oklahoma? Or are they going to face some of that same thing?
Well, it's kind of an interesting topography here. In the northern part of the state, kind of in that Cushing area and north, it's very green and a clay-like soil, and as you kind of progress south and west, it kind of turns into more, still a clay, but a little more sedimentary. And I mean, I think that play a definite factor. The other side of this coin is, you know, depending on, we talked about wastewater being injected back into the earth, but the other side of this is, you know, our rainy season comes in the spring and our potential for tornadoes goes up. But obviously just the natural water table combined with all the extra water that's being put in to the soil, you know, and the earth saturates it. And then I think you have a totally different ball game during those times of the year. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out as we progress through this.
Yeah, I didn't look up any projections, which I probably should have taken the time to do, on when and how they expect a major quake on the New Madrid to occur. It'd be interesting to look at that. But it's just like in California, I mean, they're way overdue for one. It's just they don't know. It happens when it happens. And that's one thing about earthquakes. You don't know when they're going to happen. At least if there's a tornado on the ground, you have a little bit of notice. But with earthquakes, you don't. So
yeah, on the scale of events that you can prepare for in advance, you know, you've got things at one end like hurricanes that you can see coming with modern satellite imaging and things like that days away. That you can prepare a coastline like we did for Hurricane Matthew, you know, weeks ago. And then you have tornadoes, which give you minutes of time to prepare and get into shelter. And then you have earthquakes, which provide no notice at all.
That's scary. Well, I know, you know, when we were in New Orleans for EMS World Expo, we talked to a lot of the people with New Orleans EMS and so forth. And it looks like New Orleans is probably as prepared as any place on the earth, at least as far as hurricanes are concerned. ABJ?
Like any plan, it'll never survive past the first shot. I think the biggest problem now is we have so much information that we've kind of reached that tipping point on the other side where now it's a matter of a lot of things that happen with hurricanes, and Jamie, you can attest to this with what y'all just went to. You can't pull the trigger until the government makes certain decisions and before those of us down here on the ground can do anything. And there's so much hemming and hawing that goes back and forth about which direction it's going to go, what's the percentages here, that we get a lot of delays. I mean, politicians are afraid to, say, evacuate too early because that lends itself to its own sort of problems. We've gone from just 30 years ago not knowing what was going to hit us to now we have everything in such great detail, it's gotten tough to manage in a totally different way.
So it's gotten a little complicated, huh? Well, there's just too many what ifs, especially with a hurricane. I mean, hurricanes can you know, it's not, they can project. I mean, Chris, Jamie, and I, and BJ were all in New Orleans when Matthew hit or was coming up toward the coast, and it, you know, every hour we were watching this. For one thing, Dr. Joe got deployed with his USAR, so we were kind of watching all of this going on, and it gave us a good sense of all the different steps, and even with the best projection, you never really know where it's going to go, and it was really kind of fascinating watching it with that level of detail. But let's go back to a concept we haven't talked about for a while in terms of preparedness, and BJ just kind of reminded me about this. All disasters start as local disasters. You know, they start with the incident command system and people handling it locally until they can't handle it locally. And then they bring in regional resources, and then they bring state resources. And of course, what you mentioned was the state has to make certainly certain decisions. And one of those decisions would be whether or not they need federal resources, which obviously Katrina required. But the question I have for you, Chris, is do you have, I'm actually with a nonprofit disaster organization with some people in the Midwest, and they're designing their own NIMS-like process for sharing resources in Wisconsin and Missouri and up in there through the EMAC system. Do you have anything in Oklahoma where you might share resources with other states in your area?
Absolutely, especially in the Oklahoma City area. We work very closely with our colleagues in Texas, Arkansas, Kansas, to make, you know, those resources be able to move across those state lines with ease. The disaster community here and EMS communities are very, very, very close. The other kind of interesting thought process is with my time at OU Medicine, HCA actually has a cooperative agreement with the state of Texas to staff and man a mobile hospital that can be deployed basically, you know, anywhere within about a 12-hour drive. And I've actually, when I was with OU, was able to kind of forge forward on some of those agreements and put them in place so the event we would need that asset somewhere, that could actually come into Oklahoma, be staffed by HCA and run by Texas. And obviously that's a phone call between the governors, but that is available to us. And I think that cooperatively with some of the key folks we have in Oklahoma at the regional and state levels, I think there's been some great relationships that have been built over the tornado disasters we've had. And those phone calls happen very quickly, and those assets are always available to us. So I'm thankful for our partners, and I'm thankful for the folks that have been ahead of me to forge those relationships. Obviously, anywhere in the country without that, I think we would all be in a rather tough spot.
Absolutely. Well, and if it ever goes up to the federal level, Dr. Joe with USAR and me with DMAT, we'd be there for you as well. But that brings a question in that we always like to ask, and you've had experience in the field setting and the hospital and aspirations in a number of different venues. What do you do for training? How do you train ambulance resources and hospital people and anybody that may need to be involved in a big incident like this? Do you do local events? Do you do statewide events? How do you do that?
Well, from the EMS perspective, these REMS teams are highly active with drills and coordination. We have a lot of obviously outdoor big events in Oklahoma, and a lot of times the gentleman that I mentioned before, Mike Murphy, will utilize those things to kind of coordinate that REMS response and bring in an ambulance strike team and work those situations. I think the challenge for any medical system comes in at the hospital level. The hospitals, at least in my area, I don't think they really train very well or organize in their training for these types of events. Prime example, our trauma center, which I had the opportunity to work with within for 2 years, is a great trauma facility. And I think that they develop their swagger by doing a really good job on everything that rolls through the door. I was always a proponent of, well, what happens if there's 150 people laying on your helipad? And that was not a very popular topic. So From the training aspects of it, I think from the hospital side, we need to make them more aware of what could happen, and in all actuality, that this may actually not only impact you from a patient care standpoint, but what if this earthquake occurred and we had to evacuate your hospital? You know, how would you handle that? So that side was always a big stressor for me as well, because the OU medical system actually has three hospitals within about half a block area. So the VA medical system, Children's Hospital, which is 9 floors tall, and OU Medical Center Presbyterian Tower, which is 7 floors tall. And their answer was always, well, EMS and the fire department are going to come help us. And I've always felt and tried to convey to them, they're going to be really busy pre-taking people, you know, from the scene to other facilities. So we're going to have to manage this for a little bit on our own. And I was never able to impact much, which was kind of disappointing. But I think that hopefully we would pull the community together very quickly and get that taken care of.
And I wonder what events like what happened in Orlando with the major event shooting there and all the patients suddenly showing up at their trauma center. If other trauma centers realize this type of event with massive patients just showing up could happen to anywhere.
Absolutely. And, you know, the history of Oklahoma City with the F5 tornadoes, both those went through Moore, Oklahoma, which I live in Moore, Oklahoma. And actually the level one trauma center is basically downtown Oklahoma City. So the two hospitals that were impacted the greatest by those events were Norman Regional Medical System, which is a little bit south of Moore, and Southwest Medical Center, which is a Integris facility. Both of those are level two trauma centers, but those took the bulk of patients right away, because if we couldn't get to them, they were coming, you know, privately owned vehicle, bicycle, however they could get there. So those hospitals probably have a leg up on the preparedness side, where the trauma center really hasn't had that inflow of patients.
Well, and that's a good point, Jamie, because we're talking about tornadoes and the earthquake, but, you know, there's always the potential for active shooter scenarios. I mean, they're happening all over the country, and then, you know, a number of other things that can generate a large patient load. So I really hope that the hospitals realize what the effect would be, A, if they had to evacuate everyone, or B, if they had to, what if there's a big flood? I don't know what the flooding situation is there, but it looks like there's a number of potential large hazards that could happen there. Jamie, maybe we need to get Paragon down there to work with these people.
I was thinking about that. I mean, and we want to thank Paragon Medical Education Group for being our sponsor here at the Disaster Podcast. They do a lot of amazing training and put together resources for jurisdictions large and small, and cater that specific disaster preparedness training to whatever the disasters are that locations want to prepare for. So it could be active shooter incidents, it could be USAR incidents, situations, all and everything in between. So we want to thank them for taking care of us and helping us continue to bring this podcast to you. And we just ask all of you out there to make an effort to head over to their site. You can find out more about them. They've got a great video that explains what they do, very short and sweet and to the point, over at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also find them on Twitter at paragonmededu, and you can find them on Facebook, Paragon Medical Education Group. So look them up. There's links to all that on our page at disasterpodcast.com, so you can just go right directly to them. If you look on the right-hand side, you'll find a link. But we want to thank them for supporting the show and the excellent training resources that they bring to organizations that they work with. So we want to thank Joe and Jim and the rest of the gang over there at Paragon Medical Education Group.
That's true, and we're going to miss Dr. Joe for a while. He's actually going to be working on a project in New Zealand, and I'm kind of jealous.
Yeah, me too.
I'll jump on that bandwagon.
So, Chris, we have a new Facebook page for the Disaster Podcast. It'd be great to have you pop over there and see what we're doing, and that way that's one route if people have questions on this. For you, or, you know, hopefully if they come to the disasterpodcast.com website and have some questions, we can plug you into them. Because this is fascinating stuff, and I certainly knew practically nothing that we discussed tonight. So it was very enlightening, and we appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'd be glad to go over and answer any questions and put my contact information there if that's all right with you guys, if they need to find me.
Absolutely.
It's always great talking with you and being able to expose the rest of the country to stuff goes on here in Oklahoma. And if I could be a resource for somebody, I'd gladly take the opportunity.
Well, you are my Oklahoma guy.
Yeah, thanks for coming back on the show, Chris. You know, it's nice to have you back, and don't be a stranger.
I would love to come back anytime you guys would have me. And again, honored that you would let me speak on the topic. And a quick shout out to all my veteran brothers. Happy Veterans Day tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Amen. Yeah. BJ, where can folks find you? And why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're up to? I know you and Sam have your new podcast venture.
Well, if anybody's looking for me, I can be found at xiphosbooks.net. That's xiphosbooks.net. I'm also on Facebook and all the other places under Xiphos Books. Sam and I are working on a new podcast, which is Words Off the Street. It'll be a podcast dedicated to those in public safety, police, fire, EMS, first responders, who have ventured into the world of writing, whether that be fiction, nonfiction, articles, blogs. We want to talk to those people and see how their love of public safety has turned into a new way of doing things and how they're expressing everything that they've seen and done with everybody out there.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to when that gets launched, and you can let us know more about it in a future episode then.
Yes, most certainly. We're looking to try to get a launch out of right after the first of the year. We're doing our first episodes now, but we want to make sure that we've got everything squared away and complete and ready to go, so we put out the best product for everybody out there.
Awesome. Hey, Sam, where can we find you?
Well, in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley, Sam Bradley 11. Hopefully soon I will have my writing podcast up and running. I'm working on that along with a couple of other projects, just trying to get those books up and out of there, as you remind me almost daily to do that. You are certainly my mentor in that arena. So, yeah, we're all working. If you know any EMS writers, Chris, in Oklahoma, push them our direction because we'd love to interview them eventually. But the other thing is the disasterpodcast.com website. And we mentioned the Facebook page, which is a good place for anybody who has an interest in what we're doing to come on over. And it's more of a casual chat type arena. But we'd love to hear your opinion on what we're doing and what you would like us to do and any potential guests that you have.
Yeah. And all you need to do is just go to Facebook.com and search in the search bar up there for Disaster Podcast, and it's a group that you have to get invited to. So just go ahead and click the button on the top there that says request an invite, and one of us will jump on there and get to you as quickly as we get the notification on our cell phones. It actually happens pretty quickly in a lot of cases. So once you're in the group, there's about 300 or 400 people in there now, and we've got ER docs and wilderness medicine types and paramedics and nurses and just all kinds of folks that are all there to focus on talking about disaster topics, and it's a great community.
That's a lot of people, Jamie. I didn't realize we had that many people. We can thank our friend Kevin Ryder from Texas for getting that going for us, so come on over.
Excellent. And you can find me on under the handle PodMedic in most locations on social media. And of course, always check me out over at disasterpodcast.com, where we just have a great time bringing these topics to you every week. And we want to hear more from you. You can sign up for an email list over there and get emails from us whenever a new episode is posted. And of course, also, again, over at the Facebook group as well. It's a great way. We post the episodes over there too. Sam, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, the things like earthquakes in places we don't always think about as having earthquakes, whether it's because of man-made reasons or some other situations. You know, there's a lot of things that could go wrong.
Well, and as we know, the weather seems to be getting weirder and weirder because we're starting to see these things in places you don't expect them. So I think it needs to make the point we pretty much have to be prepared for anything. And it also makes the point that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.